Yes, it's going down. Back once again. Yes, that is Coolio in the background. Today, though, we're not going to be talking about Coolio. We're going to be talking about Syria. We're going to be talking about Trump. We're going to be talking about the Democrats and Hillary Clinton. All these different war hawks, no matter what party they're in. In the last several weeks, Trump has launched a series of strikes in Syria, in Afghanistan, and in Yemen that have left many dead in an attempt to garner support from imperialist war hawks and the mainstream media, and also bounce back from plummeting poll numbers. In response, the corporate media has applauded Trump for his attack on Syria, and the Democrats continue to beat the drums of war with Russia. Meanwhile, forces within the Trump administration, such as Steve Bannon, push for open conflict with China and declare that a war is needed to reaffirm authority in the state within the millennial generation itself. Wanting to know more exactly about what is happening within the halls of power, of the differences and similarities at play between the Obama and the Trump administrations, and also, what role does Clinton play in all this? We turn towards LibCom columnist Soapy to discuss U.S. intervention, the interests at play, and the drive for war among the elites in both parties. If you don't know, LibCom is a collection of anti-state communists, situationists, and anarchists that create a really awesome website based out of the UK that's been going on for a long time. So shout out to Soapy for coming on the show. We also have new sticker packs for It's Going Down. $10 gets you about 10 stickers, 20 gets you about 30. We also have brand new t-shirts from the graffiti artist No Bonzo out of the Pacific Northwest. Hit us up. Check us out. Go to itsgoingdown.org for more information. Let's get on to the show. All right, we're joined here today with Soapy. Soapy is a longtime blogger on LibCom. If you don't know, LibCom is based out of the UK, but it has people writing across the world. LibCom is a collection of anarchist and class struggle anti-state communists. Soapy, do you want to say anything just about LibCom or about yourself before we get started?
I'm Soapy, and I have a blog on libcom.org where I basically write about issues that I don't think are, like, understood well by maybe the left and the radical left. So I try to add some clarity to it and hopefully convince some people that might not be familiar with the issues.
Sure. And if people aren't familiar with your work, you've written a lot about, working class life under the Obama administration. And as Obama was on his way out, you wrote a bunch of good pieces that were very critical, looking back at, you know, foreclosures, the economy, kind of the more nitty gritty nuts and bolts stuff that a lot of people often kind of overlook, and a lot of economic things that we really appreciate.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried to, because I looked at the criticisms that were out there in sort of the progressive left and on the radical left, and I really found they were lacking in a lot of ways, and I tried to my best to get deeper into the issue, and the deeper I got, you know, the more complicated it got, and I'd love to, you know, I never really felt like I really completed my criticisms of the administration. Maybe one day, if I have time, I'd revisit the issue.
Do you just want to summarize for people before we kind of get in, because we're going to be talking about specifically, Trump and also the recent attacks on Syria. Do you just want to summarize just kind of how you would place the Obama administration in history and just kind of their general policies of neoliberalism and so on and so forth?
Sure. Well, the Obama administration was interesting because, you know, you have different forces at play within the administration. Obama was quite a smart guy, it seems like. He understood that intervention in the Middle East would probably damage U.S. interests, and he was most concerned about the about capitalism functioning well in general. He was sort of an isolationist in a certain respect. He later said that the Libya intervention was the greatest mistake of his presidency, and he never would have intervened in Libya if it wasn't for the factions within his administration, led by Hillary Clinton, that were pushing so strongly for a more warlike stance in the Middle East. So, how it relates today is interesting, but Obama was pretty opposed to widespread military intervention in the Middle East of the sort that, you know, Bush and Clinton undertook.
And for Clinton and her faction, why are they interested in regime change? Why do they want military intervention?
Well, that's a more complicated issue. I think what's become clear is that Hillary Clinton wants to identify herself as like one of the leading international proponents of what's called humanitarian intervention. And she's really made that like a center of her branding since the late 1990s, when she really hopped on board with the Kosovo Serbia-Kosovo intervention. So that's her take, and she probably, you know, linked up there. I mean, of course, there's elements within the government that want more military intervention in other countries for a whole host of reasons, like you name it. But she probably, you know, has seen a natural ally with those forces, and she's definitely taken them under her wing and made allegiances, so to speak, with various figureheads in that sort of scene, the foreign policy, the war hawk scene, I guess you could call it.
Right. And how does this compare to the forces at play within the Trump administration? I mean, the way the media generally breaks it down is you have Bannon's economic nationalists on one side who are supposedly anti-interventionist, but also obsessed with war. And then you have, other people that are more aligned with Wall Street and seem more aligned with kind of, you know, the Hillary Clinton-ites.
Well, I like to think of the Trump administration as kind of a mess, like just a complete mess.
Okay.
it's like a disaster, but because he doesn't have any idea what he's doing. He doesn't have the slightest understanding of the situations that he's dealing with. So he just sort of, I mean, it's true Trump fashion, right? He just sort of does whatever, you know, on the day he decides to do it, He's like, he wakes up and he's like, I'm going to do this thing. And I have no, like, I am not really clear what the consequences will be, but I'm going to undertake it. So it's a little bit different in that respect. But he definitely feels the pressure. I mean, the Democrats and the Clintonites have been putting on the pressure, and the deep state have been putting on the pressure very hard from day one of his, when it was confirmed that he was going to be the president. To make him more interventionist, opposed to Russia. They don't want a rapprochement with Russia. They want to have an aggressive policy towards Syria, which is Russia's ally. So they've been putting the pressure on him, and he's really been feeling that, especially because his poll numbers are so low.
Yeah.
So he saw this chemical attack, and he just sort of acted extremely impulsively, as he does, is because he saw an easy way to score political points, and it worked. I mean, he got a bump in his poll numbers, although he didn't follow through on the attack, so it's not really clear what the long-term consequences are going to be.
Mm-hmm. I also saw that it's the most unpopular military intervention in history. I think, like, you know, out of people polled, like half of people supported it. Real quick, do you think Steve Bannon will be fired, or he'll just continue to be demoted?
That's a good question. I really don't know the answer.
Right. Well, before we kind of get into Syria, why don't you lay out just both the Democratic position and also the position, if there is one, within the Trump administration of Russia? Because, you know, throughout this whole election cycle, and also, like, in this time, like, we just hear, you know, Russia and Trump, Russia and Trump. So what are actually the forces at play about Russia, and why are those interests there? Like, can we separate the noise from the actual positions of the elites?
In terms of Russia, well, of course, the Clintonites want – Hillary Clinton has made it her – like personal mission for a long time to just be a thorn in the side of Russia, of Russian foreign policy establishment and their interests. And Syria is the last major ally in the region for Russia. They had Libya. I mean, they weren't allies with Libya, but they were on pretty good terms and they could use their ports and whatnot. But Libya was destroyed after some really, you know, backdoor or underhanded maneuvering by the NATO countries. So Syria, which is right on, you know, Russia's doorstep, so to speak, and which has important gas pipelines that flow through it, and maybe most importantly is the only Mediterranean port available for Russian ships, which is very important foreign policy wise. Mm-hmm. So they have made it very clear they're not going to let Assad fall. It's just not on the table for them, because if Assad falls, they could really be screwed. Like, their power is going to be severely diminished. So Clinton, of course,
we're talking about Russia. This is Russia's position.
Russia's position. Sorry. So Hillary Clinton's knows this and of course makes it, you know, one of her, before she, on the campaign trail, she said that one of her first actions as president would be to get rid of Assad, which, I mean, I don't know what the consequences of that would have been. It could have been much worse than anything we're seeing today. I mean, could have led to a horrible war that could have easily gone out of control. I mean, obviously there's a horrible war going on right now, but it could have gotten even worse if we could possibly imagine anything worse than what's happening in Syria right now.
Right.
So that was Hillary Clinton's approach to the situation, and she had planned on appointing to Secretary of Defense, I believe, Michelle Flournoy, who is a longtime war hawk, head of various think tanks that have been advocating for the U.S. to deploy troops into Syria to fight alongside. She seems to be under the delusion that there's, like, powerful groups of secular Syrian rebels. And that's been a talking point of the Clintonites as well, that there's supposedly these neoliberal militias that basically are, you know, and that's what they claimed with Libya too, is complete nonsense. That are aligned with U.S. interests or whatever. The strongest rebels for the past at least 5 years in Syria are Al Qaeda and ISIS. That's just the sad truth. I mean, it's a terrible situation. But if we sent troops into Syria, it's not really clear what rebel groups they'd be fighting alongside. Mm-hmm. So that's their position, right? And the Trump administration's position is, you know, day to day, whatever can get the poll numbers up. They obviously don't want a conflagration with Russia. It's not in their interests. I don't know to what extent, like, the Trump administration, like Trump himself, really understands how important Syria is to Putin, because he doesn't seem to understand, like, very basic facts like this.
Right.
There
was an interview with him on CNN or somewhere a couple days ago, and they asked him a question about Syria, and he said, yeah, we just send bombs over to Iraq. And they were like, you mean Syria, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, Syria.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to even say what the approach is, because it's not clear that he even understands the very basics of the conflict.
Right. So how does this match up with kind of like the centrist, you know, Democratic Party aligned media thing of just like, oh, there's, you know, Putin and Trump are sitting in a tree, you know, that type of stuff?
I mean, that all that stuff is just awful. It's just made by media hacks who, for whatever reason, are towing the deep state line about the need for an aggressive, more aggressive posture towards Russia, and which could lead to just, I mean, the end of the human species, basically.
Right.
It's terrible. Anybody, any liberal talking about, you know, Russia and Trump, Russia, oh my God, you know, it's awful. It's just the worst kind of suicidal foreign policy position you could possibly take.
Right. I mean, so is Bannon's, you know, we're going to go to war with China.
You know? Yeah. All that stuff.
That's why I think it's so funny to see all these people, you know, on the alt-right or, you know, the new right, like Mike Cernovich, saying that they're going to, like, release all this information of the Republican Party if, like, Bannon's fired. But yet they're, like, angry about the Syrian invasion, but they want Bannon, who's, like, is obsessed with, like, having a war in the next couple of years to make the millennial generation, like, fall in the line. I mean, it's insane to me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, okay. Encouraging the Trump administration to take on any military action is insane.
Well, hey, what could go wrong? I mean, I think you do a great job, right?
Yeah.
Make war great
exactly.
Again. Okay, well, let's get into Syria. So the first question is, what is your analysis of the current attack on Syria, and why do you think the Trump administration is making these moves?
Well, you know, like we've sort of talked about, I think that the U.S. is not capable of intervening positively in Syria. I think definitely that recent history shows that the U.S. is not capable of intervening positively in the Middle East. And the idea that anyone could possibly be in favor of a U.S.-led regime change operation after what happened in Libya or Iraq or Afghanistan, it just boggles the mind. They were, you know, these interventions were complete disasters in every way, shape, and form. But just looking at the attacks themselves, the justification given was that they bombed the airfield from which the Syrian government supposedly staged the chemical weapons attacks in the city of Idlib. There's no doubt that a chemical weapons attack happened in Idlib, but the evidence that the Syrian government was responsible is really ambiguous. We know that the rebels have chemical weapons, and we know that they've used chemical weapons multiple times in the past, and there is a large body of evidence suggesting that rebels were responsible for the 2013 sarin attack, which killed 1,400 people. the evidence put forward by the administration that the government was responsible. I've read some interesting, you know, takes saying basically that it's very thin evidence, and if anything suggests that the rebels were responsible. But obviously there's no conclusions that can be made at this point. But I think it's important to consider that both the attacks in Idlib and the attack in 2013 were undertaken at a time that made no strategic sense for Assad. I mean, Assad is wrapping up this war like pretty quickly, I mean, relative to the past 5 years. But, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are definitely on track to lose badly. And the attacks came just a week after the Trump administration made an announcement that they weren't going to intervene in the Syria conflict. So why would Assad, you know, do these attacks this time? It makes no sense. As to why I think Trump is doing this, you know, like we've touched on, it's pretty much impossible to say why he does anything, but probably to distract, you know, to distract from the problems he's having in relationship to his inability to, you know, repeal and replace Obamacare and his miserable approval ratings. And he saw the bombing in Syria as a way to get some quick and easy points with Washington pundits, and his approval ratings did receive a little bump after the attacks.
Yeah, and I mean, it totally worked. I mean, I would say, you know, the majority of the, as Chomsky would call them, the myth makers in the center, you know, totally stood up and applauded. I mean, like,
yeah,
you know, just the coverage of the Syrian intervention was pretty disgusting. I mean, people talking about the beauty of weapons and, you know, Trump became president and, you know, it was very similar to when he did his like really long speech in front of Congress, I believe.
Yeah. And then it's interesting, you know, the similarity there, because, you know, when he made the speech in front of Congress about, you know, the Navy SEAL, he applied the Navy SEAL, that attack killed, I think it was 5-7 children, the Navy SEAL attack that he was applauding. And
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just absurd.
And I think the goal there is it really has nothing to do with Trump himself. I don't think that anybody's excited about Trump, but it's about seeing an opportunity to unite, you know, at least some of the population around him, so there can be some assemblage of people feel that there's a government in place that's legitimate. I think that's all it is really like trying to,
yeah,
you know, realign legitimacy in people's minds with the state.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I mean, I just don't see that happening. I mean, I think like as CrimeThink brought up in one of the last podcasts we did is, you know, whoever would rule right now would be really unpopular because shit is breaking down.
That's true. Definitely. I think, you know, if the establishment was, well, I think, you know, we're headed, we're in a sort of untenable position. At some point, you know, things are really, I mean, dissatisfaction is really going to get too much to contain, and it's not going to express itself electorally necessarily in the future. I don't know if that's going to be a good or bad thing, but that's, you know. So I think, you know, if there was a Bernie Sanders type in the presidency, they would have an easier time calming the dissent. And if the rule, go ahead.
I mean, they might be able to do things like, you know, hey, free healthcare, or, you know, here's a free college education for a job that doesn't exist anymore, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? So there might be these kind of like things where people are like, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know, it's a brand new day.
Yeah.
And, you know, definitely, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody would disagree that if there was free universal health care, that would make lives easier for people, you know, but, yeah, just the major contradictions, you know, in the system right now, or just the fact that infrastructure is breaking down, or, you know, climate change is rapidly, you know, coming on the horizon, or just the economy. I mean, look at what's happening with, you know, retail in the U.S. right now, and just the switch to robotics and just all these bubbles that keep on bursting. So, But we can kind of come back to some of these more overarching things.
Okay.
But just continuing on, how do you see this this policy in Syria as a continuation of Obama's policies and actions in the Middle East, or are they starkly different?
Well, in terms of what Obama did specifically in Syria, after devastating Libya, the Obama administration took Libyan arms stockpiles and shipped them to Syria groups in an operation that was undertaken with the CIA in conjunction with Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. We now know that, you know, much of the arms that they shipped ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and, you know, by extension, ISIS, which eventually grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it's even more ridiculous considering that prior to the arms shipments, Al-Qaeda was pretty much destroyed. The troop surge in 2007-2008, as the Republicans put it, worked in their own sickening sense of it. But in terms of being able to destroy all forms of resistance to the Iraqi occupation. But one of those forms, of course, was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And yes, it actually did pretty much destroy the group, which was sort of had to regroup with the support of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, who saw Al-Qaeda as a way to get rid of Assad once the protests broke out in 2011. So I guess the biggest similarity here is that the U.S. is coming in to do something that can only help Al-Qaeda right at the moment when it's in some serious trouble. So Obama shipped the arms when Al-Qaeda was, you know, basically destroyed by the troop surge. And you know, now Trump did this bombing. And the bombing, make no mistake, the only person who's going to possibly benefit from any bombings of the Syrian government is Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Those are the only groups. So that's a similarity. And then I guess the other similarity is the hypocrisy. You know, the U.S. claims to be concerned about human rights while it continues to support the Saudi-led attack on Yemen, which is the driving force behind a conflict which has killed 10,000 people. It has created widespread hunger bordering on a massive famine. And the U.S. is providing bombs, money, and refueling Saudi planes on bombing runs while the Saudi government targets food production, hospitals, and other soft targets in an effort to beat the population into submission. You know, it's funny, if these liberals were and neocons were concerned about human rights abuses in the region, then why not just cut off support for Saudi Arabia? It would be much easier than entering into an immensely complicated and volatile conflict like Syria. You just stop supporting human rights abuses, you know?
Right. And to put my Chomsky hat on again, you know, as he would say, you know, the best way to stop terrorism in the world is to stop participating in it.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, moving on. And we've talked a little bit about this already, just to kind of, you know, paint the picture, but how have liberal Clintonite, as you put it, and centrist media responded, and what does this mean? You know, we've talked a little bit about the media response, but if you, anything else you want to say on it?
Well, the media responded to the attacks with unrestrained adulation. And, you know, this in turn led to a bump in Trump's approval rating. The uncritical bipartisan support that Trump is being given was given in the days after the attack, just encourages him to bomb more, to go into more conflicts that he doesn't understand and doesn't really have any long-term plan for. It's hard to even keep it in mind at the end of the day, but there's not really a way to know. The attack probably killed actual people who have faced hardships and had to make choices that these, you know, self-serving journalists could only imagine. And yet it's amazing to see how instantly everybody assumes that anybody killed in the attacks must have deserved to be incinerated, which is what happens when, I mean, that's what bombs are. They're a way to incinerate people, like, instantly. Well, actually, I don't know how painful it is. I wonder if there's a study that could be taken on that. But anyway, the celebration is pretty sickening, to be honest. And it's mind-boggling how anybody could think that U.S. intervention in the region is a good idea after what happened in Libya or Afghanistan, Iraq. Clinton's supporters seemed embarrassed at first because this is exactly what they always wanted. And then they saw Trump doing it and they're like, is this really what we wanted? But then, you know, once it was clear that Trump had no real intention to follow up on his actions, they, you know, returned to their line about humanitarian intervention. So what all this means is that we're seriously enabling and encouraging, to quote Matt Taibbi here, the world's most unapologetic asshole, into fueling his own ego by using the military. Trump probably realized, if not before the bombings, then after them, that the attacks in Syria seriously risked a major conflagration with Russia. He maybe had no idea. He was honestly that stupid. But most likely that's why he turned to North Korea, which doesn't have as strong of an ally in terms of China. You know, China's doesn't love the North Korean government, I don't think. But that being said, Trump soon learned that the North Korean situation is far more complicated than what he understood. And in fact, he gave a pretty amazing admission that he had to learn about the basic facts of the relationship between China and North Korea in a discussion with the Chinese prime minister. Like, the prime minister had to tell him, and he later admitted that. But, I mean,
what did he say? He's like, it was a lot to learn or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. No, like, I it's like, I had no idea it was so complicated or something like that. Right. And it's like, and this is the man that we're encouraging to use the U.S. military, you know, in any capacity, any military capacity. Right. It's just, you know, why would we want to encourage that?
Well, let's go back a little bit to the Clinton supporters and kind of their mental conundrum supporting Trump or not. I mean, how have you seen reaction on the left to this intervention? Because, I mean, we've seen some people, you know, Assad's an anti-imperialist, we've got to support him. Or, you know, Clinton people being like, oh, you know, this is a great humanitarian intervention. I mean, how have you seen it played out?
Well, in terms of the last point, the sad reality is that the situation is just awful for everyone in Syria. And that's just the sad truth. I mean, there's liberals who, you know, they attack Trump immediately after the bombings by saying, like, you know, the airfield that he bombed is still operational, and so he didn't really do a good job. Hillary Clinton would have done a better job doing it, and she wouldn't have gone to war because of her own ego. She would have gone to war because she cares about the Syrian people, which is just absurd. I mean, we're talking about one of the most duplicitous politicians in history, and we're supposed to think she cares about Syrian children. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But I mean, that's what people have to understand, that there's no easy way out of this. I think, you know, the U.S. should be a little more serious about trying to the U.S. has sort of lost credibility even to lead a peace initiative after what happened in Libya, because Russia is not interested in hearing what the U.S. has to say about brokering any sort of peaceful settlement. Mm-hmm. So,
in one of the most recent SNL episodes, they had a really interesting skit where Trump goes to some, like, I don't know if it's like a Rust Belt town or some, you know, Midwest area where there's like a bunch of, you know, working class white people, and they're all asking him questions, you know, like, hey, you know, I just got laid off. Or one of the people was like, hey, my wife's addicted to painkillers, and, you know, or somebody was like, hey, my healthcare is about to run out and my premiums are going up. And basically Trump was just like, yeah, you're screwed, but, you know, you still love me, so who cares? And their response was like, yeah, you know, we're not going to vote for you, so whatever.
Yeah.
So how is these interventions and war in general connected with oppression at home and general attacks on the poor, working an oppressed population, you would say?
Well, like I had mentioned before, after destroying Libya, the Obama administration took Libyan arms stockpiles and shipped them to Syria. And at the time, they thought that they were giving the weapons to, you know, these neoliberal militia groups that supposedly shared U.S. Values. When it became, you know, after the attacks in Benghazi, it started really becoming clear that the people they were giving the weapons to were, in fact, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They ended the program, and the Obama administration shifted over to this program of trying to create the sort of astroturf these militia groups that they wanted to see. And between 2012 and 2015, the U.S. spent $1 billion a year on training in a single program. There were other programs that cost like similar amounts, but one single program cost $1 billion a year between 2012 and 2015 to train the sort of militiamen that the U.S. wanted to see. The programs were a complete disaster, but one in every $15 in the CIA spent in 2013 went to these programs. So if you can imagine, you know, we're talking about at least $3.5 billion here. To give an idea of what that means, we could build a high-speed rail system between Chicago, Milwaukee, and Madison for less than $1 billion, and we could spend just $600,000 a year to maintain it. That would put people to work. It would be eco-friendly. It would reduce the stress of commuting times. But instead, we use it on – I mean, not only do we use it on our foreign policy adventures, but we use it in a way in which it doesn't even further the supposed interests of the government. I mean, the program's failed. But the reason that we don't use money in a way that's logical, not even for, you know, having healthy, functioning society, but also for just having a healthy capitalist system that is able to sustain itself for an indefinite amount of time. The reason that we don't do that is because neoliberalism is not only a model of economic organization, but it's also an ideology. It's an ideology of relentless war, class war against the poor, even at the cost of long-term economic growth. Neoliberals would rather live in a crisis-ridden economy, relying on a collapsing infrastructure, than let ordinary people live comfortable, fulfilling lives. From the perspective of the ruling class, it's much more important to spend money on pointless foreign policy efforts than on creating jobs, helping the environment, or alleviating traffic congestion. The other way these actions affect us at home is that they greatly increase the chances of terror attacks. Like I said, the people who benefit from who have benefited in past years from our actions are Al-Qaeda and ISIS. When Gaddafi fell, jihadis flooded into the country, and it's now home to upwards of 5,000 ISIS fighters. So the possibility of terror attacks are greatly increased by our actions, and any terror attack on U.S. soil is just going to kick the repression at home into overdrive, and it's going to punish all sorts of minority populations.
I mean, we asked this of several people that have been on the program, but would you classify Trump as, like, you know, authoritarian neoliberal? I mean, how would you place him on the political spectrum?
I think Matt Taibbi said he's sort of like a con man running out of ideas.
Okay.
I think he just...
I don't even mean Trump, like, specifically, but just kind of like the whole enchilada.
Whole enchilada, like what we're seeing right now.
Or just, you know, like if there could be a generalized, you know, analysis of the administration, just kind of like how you would place them. I know there's different factions within it, and it's more of a coalition of a bunch of different groups. But if you had to place, you know, kind of their overall project, you know, where would that go?
I I just think they don't really know what they're doing. And so it's not really easy to place them in any sort of ideological spectrum other than they're all egotistical and want to further their own, like, personal, like, very personal interests, like their image and brand. They don't have – I don't think they have really any overarching plan for the society. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe – Trump got to the point where he was actually nominated, the Republican nominee, and, you know, at the convention, he – and it was sort of a surprising move. Everyone expected him at the convention to, you know, sort of double down on his, like, more authoritarian imagery and all that sort of thing and populism and whatnot. But really what ended up happening was that he just returned to, like, basic Republican – policy platforms that, and it wasn't really a departure from the norm that he was espousing. And then I think that was furthered when he got into the administration, probably because he doesn't really know what he's doing. So he just wants to do, he's trying to figure it out, like, as he goes along. So he just does, like, what people have done in the recent past, because he doesn't have any plan of his own.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that made any sense, but
sure. Yeah. I mean, how would you see, I mean, what do you see happening in the future with the Trump administration? I mean, how do you see things continuing to break down? You kind of alluded to just coming to the head of a crisis of legitimacy with the state. And how do you see that playing out?
Who knows? I mean, that's the thing about Trump is he's very unpredictable, probably because, you know, he doesn't understand the basics of how the world works. So it's just day to day, and we'll see what happens. I mean, you can obviously hope for the best that people will finally wake up and see that the right wing does not offer any solutions for the country. That's certainly what we can hope for, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think as other people have written, I think it's true. I think at some point, I mean, right now it seems like a lot of the left is, you know, marching in circles, you know, making pictures of Trump as a duck, saying that they want his tax return information or some dumb shit.
Yeah.
You know, I think anarchists are trying to put their energy elsewhere, which I think is, you know, intelligent. But I think at some point, you know, there is going to be another wave of anti-police riots. I think there's going to be other big struggles that, like, take the country's attention. I think it's going to happen.
Okay.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how Trump reacts. Like, if Trump seizes on that, because I think if there's anything that unites his base, it's a hatred of the left. It's a hatred of anarchists and anti-fascists. It's a hatred of Black Lives Matter. Anybody that's basically on the bottom, mm-hmm. that's trying to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's going to be scary, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I will hope for the best.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Soapy. Is there anything else you want to say? Any shout-outs or, you know, people can follow you on Twitter. Definitely check out your blog on LibCom. Anything else you want to go over or say?
No. Thanks for having me on. You can follow me at Soapy LibCom on Twitter. Yeah, thanks.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us, and we'll hope to hear from you soon. Thanks for talking about a lot of these really complex issues and really breaking it down for us. It's been great.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Soapy from LibCom, for coming on the It's Going Down podcast. Thank you, the listener, for listening all the way to the very, very end. And hey, if you want to drop some money in our tip jar, if you want to help support It's Going Down and the work that we're doing, there's no better time than now to donate, because right now we have brand new sticker packs. If you donate $10, you get over 10 stickers. If you donate $20, you could actually three times the amount, over 30 stickers. And we have brand new t-shirts from the legendary graffiti artist No Bonzo from the Pacific Northwest. So please go to itsgoingdown.org, check us out, see how you can donate, and get your awesome shit. Also, next month, as we've been saying, we will be switching to Patreon. Essentially all it is, a platform that allows you every month to donate money to support projects that you want to see grow and expand. And that's exactly what we want to do at itsgoingdown.org. There's a lot of things that we want to do that we really can't do right now, and we need your help to do that, to keep growing and keep getting bigger. In many ways, we've kind of hit a wall with what we can do with the resources that we have. In order to get bigger, we're going to have to bring more people into this project and keep fucking going. But in order to do that, we need your help. So at the start of May, right after May Day, around that time, be sure to check out It's Going Down. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of stuff going on anyway. But when we give the call out to support our Patreon, we're really hoping that people step up and really help us continue to grow. Every single day on the site, we're getting an extreme amount of hits. We're getting between about 20 to 30,000 original viewers. So there's no better time to continue to support It's Going Down and grow this platform, because we're only getting bigger. Let's continue to grow, but we're gonna have to do it together. This isn't about one single person. This is about us as a movement. So we look forward to growing with you and the task and the work that lies ahead. Thanks a lot.
Dancing on the crumbling precipice, the rocks are coming loose to set the earth. Are we laughing? Are we crying? Are we drowning? Are we dead? Or is it all a dream? The rocks are getting closer every day. That can never happen here, we used to say. Happy sports go to our doorstep. Has this moment finally come? Or is it all a dream? Are we not good enough? Are we not brave enough? Is the violence in our nature just the image of our maker? Are we not good enough? Are we not brave enough? To think of something greater than our violence in our nature? Are we not good enough? Or is it all a dream? To a predetermined fate are we condemned? Or maybe we're a bug without a name. We're not stories, we're not actors. We're awake and in control. And this is not a dream. So can we break this mold and set in motion something new? Forgetting what we know, an evolution overdue. Fight the current, pull the ripcord, get away. Are we not good enough? Are we not brave enough? Is the violence in our nature just the image of our maker? Are we not good enough? Are we not brave enough? To think of something greater than our violence in our nature? Are we not good enough? Are we not good enough? Are we not brave enough? Is the violence in our nature just the image of our maker?